My name is Paul Deaton with Blog for Iowa, where this year we are celebrating 20 years of continuous publication. Joining me today is Tom Hartman. Tom is a New York Times best-selling author and America's number one progressive talk radio show host for more than a decade. Today we'll be talking about his new book, The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class, and How to Rescue Our Future. Welcome back, Tom.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Paul. It's great to be here with you.
We'll just get right down to it. So why this book now, Tom?
I think that the middle class has been under assault ever since the Reagan Revolution, ever since 1981. And that assault has shrank the American middle class from about two-thirds of us when Reagan came into office down to, depending on whose numbers you're using, between 43 and 47% of us now. And that has produced an enormous backlash. And that backlash has been largely what has fueled the Trump movement over the last, more or less decade, 9 years, certainly. And so I felt that it was really important to address, what has happened? Why did we build and how did we build a middle class in the United States between 1933, the world's first, by the way, to reach more than 50% of the population between 1933 and 1981? And then why, when Reagan came into office, did he have a mandate from the GOP and his donors to deconstruct, to gut that middle class that we had so carefully built? And how has he been successful at that? And then I guess the third part in the book as well is, then what do we do to try to restore or reclaim that middle class, that American dream?
Well, I'm familiar with the Reagan era since I came up in it. And when we married in 1982, I felt the American dream was on life support. It existed for my parents, but not for me, and certainly not for our child. And so my question is, why is the term American dream still relevant?
I think it's not just relevant. I think it's important because it's part of the mythology of our country. It's something that for a long, long time we've all taken very seriously as the land of opportunity. And sometimes Republicans tend to talk about the American dream in terms of you too can become Elon Musk, but I think most people understand the American dream to be that, you can have a decent life. My dad worked in a tool and die shop all his life, and yet he was able to buy a house, raise four boys, put some of us through college, buy a new house, new car every 2-3 years, had a good pension for retirement, had a decent life. And that's something that should be available to basically to all Americans. And other countries around the world have demonstrated that it is possible to have a very widespread, very large scale middle class. It's just that here in the United States, particularly in the 1950s and 60s, we had a group of conservative thinkers who believed that the middle class was a dire threat to America, and that animated the Reagan Revolution.
When we talk about a middle class, a strong middle class, education is important, as you point out in the book. And that's particularly relevant here in Iowa, where I am. Our governor has gone all in on private school vouchers with an unlimited appropriation. And the outcome of voucher programs is pretty obvious, especially in the state of Kansas, where it drew so much money away from the state budget that major programs were in jeopardy of being short-funded. So my question is, are states like Kansas and Iowa innovators, or are they simply sheep following the direction of Americans for Prosperity and the American Legislative Exchange Council?
Yeah, clearly the latter, Paul. And they're also trying to take America back to the period prior to the 1890s, when we didn't have public schools by and large in the United States. Private schools are fine if you're wealthy. And of course, it's wealthy Republicans who are driving this movement. But, this voucherization movement is just, and part of the mission of it is to destroy public schools, because most public schools are unionized. And of course, Republicans hate unions as well. And they want to be able to control the American history that's being taught. They're very uncomfortable with, people learning about, the mass genocide of Native Americans or the true history of slavery, things like that. So it's unfortunate. The other thing is, with college, and I get into this in some detail in the book, the great lesson we learned from the GI Bill was that for every dollar that we as a nation invest in college education for people, we get back $7 in tax revenue that we wouldn't have otherwise had, because those people who are now college educated make so much more money than people who are not college educated that they pay more in taxes. And so the GI Bill paid for itself on a 700% return on investment basis. And yet, ever since 1981, we've been trying to make it harder and more expensive for people to go to college, rather than, as is happening in every other advanced democracy in the world, rather than making it cheaper to go to college and encouraging people to go to college. It's just been totally counterintuitive. And again, it all tracks back to this bizarre idea that Russell Kirk and some of his followers had in the early 1950s. He wrote a book in 1951 called The Conservative Mind, From Eliot to Burke. And Kirk suggested essentially that at that point in time, we were just approaching about half of us being in the middle class. And it was a big event, something that the world had never really seen before. And as that was happening, Kirk said, if the middle class ever gets too large, you will know that it is too large, because you'll see society start to fracture, start to disintegrate, because these middle class people don't have the college education. They didn't come from wealth. They didn't come from multiple generations of people who were leaders and governors and captains of industry. And so they just don't know how to appropriately run a government. And so you're going to have social chaos. You're going to see three big things. You're going to see women leaving their proper place in society. You're going to see young people no longer respecting their elders and thus producing social revolution. And you're going to see minorities no longer acknowledging their place in society. And, he was largely considered a crackpot in 1951 when he published that book, although William F. Buckley and Barry Goldwater were just captivated by it. But in the 1960s, in 1961, the FDA approved the birth control pill. So by 64, 65, you had a major women's movement underway, the women wanting to get into the workplace. In 65, you had the Vietnam War, which led to the anti-Vietnam War movement, 66, 67, 68, and so forth. And then you had, throughout that entire decade, the peak of the power of the civil rights movement. So, and particularly after King was assassinated, as cities were in flames around America, young men were saying, hell no, I'm not going to go to Vietnam. And women were demanding rights in the workplace in particular. Republicans looked around and said, holy crap, Russell Kirk was right. We are having social chaos, and it must be because this middle class got too big. And so Reagan was elected with a mandate, basically, to gut the middle class, to chop it back down to a respectable size, to make it so the kids were afraid of getting kicked out of college, throw them into debt, so that women would not have access to resources and the freedom to fully participate in the workplace, do away with legal abortion. And so that, minorities would no longer have a ladder to success, do away with things like affirmative action and frankly, civil rights laws and certainly voting rights laws. And so Reagan came into office with that mandate. And the first thing he did was destroy the union movement. When he came into office, about two-thirds of us had the equivalent of a good union job. About a third of us were unionized. The unions were setting the wage floor for everybody else. He went after the unions. He went after education, 18% cut in education. When he came into office, 80% of the cost of college was paid for with federal and state money, and only 20% was tuition. Today, it's the exact opposite. Today, tuition pays 80% of the cost of college, only 20% federal and state money. That was Reagan's work. And thus, we have a $2 trillion student debt crisis. And now we're having wars over what kind of history we can teach in our schools. It's the success of the Reagan Revolution has been the destruction of the American middle class. And now we've got the Republican Party via Donald Trump trying to blame Democrats for it, which is weird.
Yeah, I have to agree. It is weird. There was a lot in what you just said, but we have limits of time. But I want to talk about what you call the right to work for less. And my story is that when I got out of my freshman year of college, I went to work in a meatpacking plant. And while I was in processing there, the human resources person explained that Iowa was a right-to-work state, and that meant that we could be fired for any reason or for no reason. And then he left, and the union came in to recruit us to join. And everyone in my group joined the union. So I guess my question, from the longer perspective back to the 70s and before, what, if anything, has changed regarding right-to-work?
Yeah, just for people who don't know what we're talking about, in 1935, Franklin Roosevelt got the Wagner Act passed. It's also called the National Labor Relations Act, and that made it illegal for employers to refuse to allow workers to have a union. In 1947, over two vetoes by Harry Truman, the Republican-controlled House and Senate passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which provided something that's called which created this thing called right to work. And what it says principally is that number one, any state that wants to adopt Taft-Hartley can opt out of the Wagner Act provisions that require you to join the union and require the state to recognize the union. And secondly, you can go to work in a union shop, in a shop where there is union representation, and you can benefit from that union representation. In fact, you can force the union to defend you in a court of law with their own lawyers at their own expense, but you don't have to pay union dues unless you want to. It's voluntary. And this is a way of just destroying unions. And it's been very, very successful in the 20-some-odd states. All the Republican-controlled states in America are now right-to-work-for-less states. And there's only a handful of Democratic states, and they all went that way when Republicans controlled them. Michigan was for a while. I don't know if they repealed it yet or not, for example. And so, right to work is really a cudgel. It's a hammer that is used to smash unions, to destroy unions and union movements. And then on top of that, of course, over the years we've seen about a dozen Supreme Court decisions. There's a chapter from my book on the Supreme Court that I put online at tomharbin.com/labor.pdf that details all of those Supreme Court decisions that have gutted every single one of them, 5-4 decisions entirely by Republicans on the court that have gutted many of the protections of the Wagner Act. So the union movement has been really struggling since the 80s in a big way, and really since 1947. It's just that it wasn't until, I believe, the late 70s that the National Right to Work Organization, which is kind of a lobbying group for hating unions, really got their mojo together and came into being. And now it's a multi-billion-dollar industry, union busting.
Oh, that's a very helpful history. And so I guess when I think about my experience in 1971 and what's going on today over at the University of Iowa Hospitals, SEIU got representation of several business units. And their recruitment for union members is nowhere like it was in the meatpacking plants when I was a union member. And that's because of right to work and an open shop. And workers don't have to join the union, and many don't. And right now, unions are at an impasse regarding membership. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about how to break that impasse so that more employees join unions where they're available.
Well, the key to it I mean, the particularly vicious thing, and that was a word that Harry Truman used to describe Taft-Hartley. He always referred to it as the vicious Taft-Hartley Act. And the vicious thing about it is that it says that a union is legally required. A union can be decertified. In fact, union officials can even go to jail if they refuse to defend any of their workers. If they refuse to spend resources on any of the people in a place of employment, but those people don't have to pay union dues. These are called free riders. And in many cases, what has happened is you've got people who have gone to work in a workplace. They get some funding from one of these outside groups. Sometimes they even go to just get the job to do this. They then sue the union. Or they make actions in the workplace that will hurt the union, and then they force the union to defend them, because the union can't just pick and choose. They've got to defend all workers under all circumstances, basically by law. And so what this does is it just drains the resources of the unions at the same time that they're under attack. So the only way to correct that is for a state to repudiate their adoption of Taft-Hartley and go back to operating under the provisions of the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which require if an employer is unionized, that everybody be a member of the union, that you have what's called a closed shop, that everybody be a member of the union, everybody pay their dues. Closed shops nowadays only exist in blue states. They don't exist in red states because of the Taft-Hartley Act. And so that's something in Iowa, for example, where you live, you'd have to get the Iowa legislature to withdraw themselves from participation in Taft-Hartley.
All right. Talking about getting the legislature back, I want to talk a little bit about this Ann Seltzer Des Moines Register poll that was released on September 14th. And what they found was that Trump's lead in Iowa deteriorated from a plus 18 against Biden to a plus 4 against Harris. So a huge, huge change, 14 points. But what was interesting about the poll was it showed a sharp divide between men and women likely voters. Trump leads with men 59-32% over Harris, and Harris leads with women 53-36%. And this is no surprise to us who are on the ground talking to voters, because the Republican governor and legislator just pummeled public education and women's reproductive rights the last two general assemblies. So I guess this is kind of a roundabout way of getting there. I mean, we hope that this drive of division between men and women and how they vote will help us to move our minority closer to a majority this time. But how do you see the role of women in restoring the American dream?
I think that it's kind of cliched, but cliches are often cliches because there's a germ of truth in them, to suggest that women are more concerned about the future. They're more concerned about the world our children are going to inherit, perhaps because, they gestate children, the children grow in them and come from them. And very often women are the primary caregivers of children. Or maybe it's just, how women and men are just constructed differently or something. But it seems to me that Trump and the Republican Party these days are running campaigns that are really just designed to get men, and particularly men who don't particularly like women, misogynistic men. And Kamala Harris, being a woman, has an added advantage with women to begin with. And then secondly, I think most rational men look at her and her policies and say, yeah, she could run this country, and she's got good policies too, so let's do it. I think probably one of the few advanced democracies that has not had a woman in leadership. And there's no doubt that women can run a country. I mean, look at Angela Merkel in Germany, for example. Mm-hmm. Or Maggie Thatcher in England. I didn't agree with her policies, but she sure knew how to take names and kick ass. Mm-hmm. So I'm quite optimistic. I don't know how Iowa's going to go, but nationally I'm quite optimistic about this election.
Well, I think the grassroots support among women for change is pretty strong right now. So we'll see. We got 7 weeks to go here, so we'll see how we do. I wanted to talk. You mentioned almost in passing in your book about Substacks, and of course they produce revenue for the authors. And my question for you is how do Substacks and other paid subscription formats from popular yet individual authors impact the overall media ecosphere?
I don't think they have taken anything down. I think what they've done is they've opened up a new opportunity for authors and writers. Most Substack newsletters, and it's not just unique to Substack, there's Ghost.io and there's, you know, a bunch of competitors, Medium.com. Most of these newsletters are absolutely free. And when people, there are some people who charge for access to their newsletters, but they're very much in the minority, probably fewer than 1%, or maybe 5%. And by and large, when people say, yes, I'm going to pay for this newsletter, what they're saying is, I want to support this particular author. I like the way that he or she is writing. I like what they have to say. And I want to, you know, I just want to help them, you know, make it in this world. Yeah. And that, what that has done is it's allowed a number of people who were kind of stuck in the corporate mill, or who have been writing for years and years for very little compensation or none at all. I mean, a lot of these sites, you know, just don't pay. If you submit a piece to them, they don't pay anything. And even if you get to be a writer for some of the bigger magazines, you know, you might make $100 or $200 or $300 for an article that takes you 2 weeks to produce. Mm-hmm. So what Substack has done, I can, you know, speaking for myself, is it's given me some freedom. I'm still writing for the same publications and I'm still writing in the same way. But I'm also consolidating my writing at harbinreport.com, which is my main Substack, although we have four of them all together now, one for the TV show or one for the radio TV show, which is tom.tv, one on ADHD and one on kind of esoterica. I think it's a great innovation. I really do.
All right. So you don't think it's going to hurt the overall media environment?
It looks to me like it's actually expanding it, that it's helping it.
All right, fair enough. Almost everybody I know is doing something to contribute to this year's election campaigns. They don't want to be left out. They want to be part of a victory. And I guess from your perspective, what are one or two things that are most important for progressives to be doing right now to contribute to a successful result on November 5th?
Well, there's this thing called the bandwagon effect, you know, and it's well known in politics and in psychology, which is that, you know, when we think that a lot of our friends think a particular way, we give it credibility and we take it seriously. And when we think that it's an outlier or it's rare, it's easier to dismiss. And so I think it's really important for those people who actually believe in democracy and the American dream and want America to move forward and are not fans of, you know, racist hating like, you know, Trump and Vance are trying to sell, to just come right out and say, you know, I'm with the Democrats this year. I'm with Kamala Harris this year. And Tim Walz, and I want to move this country forward and be public in those proclamations to the extent that you feel safe doing that, whether it's putting a lawn sign out or, you know, sharing articles and memes with friends or posting on social media or, you know, bringing it up in conversation. I think that that's each one of us being an evangelist is frankly more powerful than any of the contributions that we can make or any of the, you know, door knocking and phone calls and postcards are important. And there are ways that you can do those things. There's a bunch of groups that help with that. Indivisible.org is probably the most famous. But not everybody can do those things. Not everybody has the time. Not everybody has the inclination. But what I was talking about, you know, just becoming evangelical about, you know, this election, that's something that's available to most everybody. And I encourage people to adopt it, those kind of policies, those kind of positions.
All right. Well, thanks for that. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the new book here before we wrap up?
It's kind of a cautionary tale. I mean, we made the first of all, middle classes are not normal things in capitalist societies. The unregulated capitalism almost always produces the world that Charles Dickens wrote about in Christmas Carol, where you've got the top 1% who are the ultra, ultra rich at the top. Then you've got a middle class that's only 2 or 3 or 4%, which is the doctors, the lawyers, and the shopkeepers. Ebenezer Scrooge was a small businessman. He owned a tiny business with one employee, and yet he was the middle class. And then you've got this 95% who are the working poor. That's what normal capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, produces and has throughout the history of the world. So when Franklin Roosevelt came along in 33 and as president, looking at the destruction of the Republican Great Depression, he said, we're going to build a middle class. We're going to do it. And he did. He got us to two-thirds of us being in the middle class by 1981. And then, as I told you earlier, you know, Reagan came in and said, oh, no, this is dangerous. This is leading to all this social instability of the 60s. We're going to gut that middle class. Well, now we're at this inflection point. The last 3 years, the Biden presidency has been the first Democratic administration since Jimmy Carter to abandon neoliberalism. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama basically just continued Reaganism, continued his austerity economics. And Biden has been pushing back on this. He's breaking up big monopolies. He's put tariffs on imported goods. He's arguing forcefully for unionization and union rights and against Taft-Hartley. He's made a huge break. I mean, this is a return to FDR and Keynesian economics. And it has put America back together, and it's strengthened us so much that, you know, for the first time in a long, long time, we've had a real spike in interest rates without a depression or a recession, rather. So I think that we're at a moment here that is going to decide, at least for a generation, the future of America. And that's even setting aside bigger issues like climate change. It's going to decide whether we're going to continue to grow the middle class, as Biden has been doing for the last 3 years, or whether we're going to go back to where we were 5 years ago and continue to shrink the middle class as we had done for 43 years under Reaganism. I think this is a real pivot point in history. And Kamala Harris has made it very clear that she's with Joe Biden in this, not with the Clintons and not with the Republicans. And I find that very, very exciting. Very, very, it's got me thinking very optimistically about the future.
Yeah, it's hard not to feel that, I believe. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Tom. Again, the name of the book is The Hidden History of the American Dream, The Demise of the Middle Class and How to Rescue Our Future by Tom Hartman. Thanks again, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Paul. It's great talking with you again.
All right. Have a great day.
Thanks.